Okay, today we are going to cover Numbers chapters 25 through 27, but we'll do a review from the last time, which was actually before the feast back in September, so it was a while back, but we'll briefly review what we talked about the last time. In chapter 22, we talked about the fact that the children of Israel were on the plains of Moab. They were not too far from the Jordan River, just about ready to go into the Promised Land. But yet there were several events that had to take place before they would go into the Promised Land. So chapter 2 begins with them on the plains of Moab. Balak, who is king of Moab, a nearby nation, feared Israel because they had already defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, which is another king. So he sent for Balaam, who was a known diviner in Mesopotamia, he sent for him to come and curse Israel. But God informs Balaam, this diviner, that he cannot curse Israel because Israel is blessed. In chapter 23, we see that Balaam had Balak, who is the king of Moab, build altars and perform pagan sacrifices and rituals to try to seek a revelation from God. So they do these pagan sacrifices and rituals trying to get a revelation from God because Balaam wanted to curse Israel. However, God opens Balaam's mouth in 7 oracles to bless Israel rather than cursing them. And that was in chapter 23. And briefly in chapter 24, Balaam continues with his oracles that bless Israel rather than curse them. So we find that Balaam's plan, Balaam and Balak's plan to curse Israel is not permitted by God. We finished up the last time with chapter 24, verse 25, which reads, "So Balaam rose and departed and returned to his place. Balak also went his way." Now, that phrase there where it says, "he returned to his place" in the English translation is misleading. Because if you remember, I said that Balaam had come from Mesopotamia 300 miles away. So if you think, if we assume that he went back to Mesopotamia, it's like he returned to his place and we never hear from him again. But that's not true. A better translation from the Hebrew is that he went his way or to another place. And in this other place, although he was unsuccessful to curse Israel, he devises another plan to attack Israel. That's what we're going to read about in chapter 25. However, before we get into chapter 25 with Balaam's plan to bring Israel down, please turn with me in your Bibles. I don't have this on the screen. Back to Genesis chapter 15. And let's understand what's going to happen here and what's taking place at this particular moment in history. Genesis chapter 15. And this is God talking to Abraham here about the future that would happen to his descendants. Let's pick it up in Genesis chapter 15, verse 13. He says this, "Then God said to Abram, 'Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land,'" talking about Egypt, "'that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them for 400 years. Great amount of time is going to go by while they're in Egypt. Verse 14, "Also the nation whom they serve, I will judge." God's going to judge Egypt. "And afterward they shall come out with great possessions." All the spoils that they received from the Egyptians when they left. Verse 15, "Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age." Then notice verse 16. This is what I want to focus on. "But in the fourth generation," the generation to come out of Egypt, or after all that time, etc., "but in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." Notice that phrase, "the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." God is talking about the fact, and the Amorites here refer to generally the Canaanites in general, that things are going to get so bad with them. In fact, this word iniquity can be translated the perversity. The perversity of the Amorites is not yet complete. It's going to get so perverse with them, I'm going to have to judge them, is what God is saying. In fact, I'd like to read from the today's English version how verse 16 reads. It reads like this. It will be 4 generations before your descendants come back here, because I will not drive out the Amorites until they become so wicked that they must be punished. And that's the moment of history that we're coming on here in the book of Numbers, chapter 25. The Amorites, or the Canaanites in general, the people in this area in Transjordan, have become so perverse, so wicked, that judgment's going to come upon them. And they're so perverse, they're going to actually influence this young generation of Israelites. That's what we have come to here now, and that's what we're going to discuss in chapter 25. Chapter 25, Israel is seduced by Moab. And again, this is the young generation. The older generation has already died in the wilderness wanderings. Unfortunately, this is one of the saddest moments of Israel's history, of all the sad moments, the way that they fall. Okay, verse number 1. Now Israel remained in the acacia grove, or if you're reading in the Old King James, the term is Shittim. And notice, and people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. Now we're going to find out when we come to Numbers 31, verse 16, that this harlotry committed with the women of Moab was through the counsel of Balaam. So Balaam failed in cursing Israel. He comes up with this other plan and uses these women of Moab to cause Israel to commit harlotry with them, physical adultery. But it gets worse. Notice verse number 2. They invited the people of Israel, to the sacrifices of their gods, like the ones that Balak and Balaam had offered previously, the pagan sacrifices. They invite Israel to participate. And notice, and the people ate. They ate the meat that was sacrificed to the pagan gods. But it gets worse. And they bowed down to their gods. Israel begins to worship these pagan gods. Verse number 3. So Israel was joined, which is talking about a spiritual union, to Baal of Peor. And what happens? And the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. Big time. How far they had fallen here in this particular event. Now think about this. All the lessons that they had learned, seeing their fathers and their mothers die because of their sins and the mistakes they had made, and the mistakes that they had made as well, the grumblings and the murmurings, all the lessons through the years of wandering had been forgotten. And they fall big time. Now verse 1, in the New King James, it talks about the acacia grove. In the Old King James, it's the Shittim. Literally, it means it's the acacias in Moab. Remember I talked about the fact in Exodus that there were many trees in the desert that were called acacia trees. So this was an oasis of acacia trees where they were camped. And this is the last encampment before they crossed the Jordan. Think about that. There's the promised land. I think if I remember right from reading the commentaries, they were something like 7 miles away from the River Jordan, the promised land. And yet, here they fall when the promised land was in their reach. They commit harlotry, both physical adultery and spiritual adultery as well, sacrificing to the pagan gods and worshiping them. Sacred prostitution was common among the Canaanite religion, where they actually had the prostitutes that would invite you to go in and worship the gods, and you know, we can go on further, but it was perverse. We see here in verse number 3 that they were spiritually joined to Baal of Peor. The Companion Bible points out that Baal means Lord, the Lord in that particular religion. And Peor here was the mountain on which this god was worshipped. Baal was a Moabite and a Canaanite idol. And those who who called the Israelites were the prostitutes necessary for worship by others. Now, Baal here, this is the first time that Israel runs into this particular god, Baal. And Baal of Peor is the same god that the Canaanites in the land of Canaan worshipped as well. This was the god, one of the gods that Israel was supposed to eliminate when they go into the promised land. God had told them, remember, that I'm sending you into the promised land to get rid of all this wickedness. And yet they fall to it. In the pantheon, in the figure of their particular gods, in this particular religion, Baal was the father god. The mother was Ashtarte, or Astarte, which is where our English word Easter comes from. And in that particular religion, they used the asherim in their worship, which was the sacred trees that they used. And I don't think I need to explain what the significance of the sacred trees are. That has come down in worship in common religion today. Goes all the way back to those ancient times, still exists today. Okay, I've got a map here on the screen for you here now. Here's where they were. Right here is the Jordan River. And here you see Jericho. Here's the Promised Land, Bethlehem, Jerusalem. And they're camped right here in the Acacia Grove. This was something like 7 miles from the River Jordan. That's how close they were to the Promised Land. Sihon, king of the Amorites, Israel had defeated, and they had taken control of this area. And the Midianites were going to run across them. A group of Midianites were also living in this area under Sihon and had come under the rule of Israel now as they had taken control of this particular area. The Midianites were desert wanderers that wandered throughout the desert, nomad-type people that were found in the Sinai region. They were found in the region that would eventually become Saudi Arabia. But every now and then, groups of them settled into certain areas. And there was a group of Midianites that were in this area, living under Sihon, who Israel defeated. Now they are in amongst the Israelites. And they're going to influence them as we see, as we continue on. Okay, so let's go back to verse number 2 now, and let's evaluate a little bit closer. We read, they invited the people to sacrifice, to the sacrifice of their gods, and the people ate, bowed down to their gods. Verse 3, so Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. We're going to see a plague is going to come upon them because of that. Verse 2 says, they, referring to the women of Moab, invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods. Now this is explained in other parts of the scriptures as well. Revelation chapter 2, verse 14. This is where Balaam had advised Balak to set a trap for Israel and explained in Revelation. Verse 14 reads, but I have a few things against you, because when John was writing this, there was a similar influences in that time of the world. But I have a few things against you, because you have those there who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel. What was the stumbling block? To eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit sexual immorality, which led to spiritual immorality. And John is describing there were people in his day that were doing the same thing, setting a trap for Christians in that day and time, just like Balaam had done. And that has continued on down throughout the centuries, traps set for the brethren. Also in Psalms chapter 106, verse 28, there's a good section describing this event that took place. I've only got one verse for you here. Psalm 106, verse 28, it says, they joined, referring to Israel, they joined themselves also to Baal of Peor. And notice, and ate sacrifices made to the dead. Now, if you're reading in the original King James, the translation is sacrifices of the dead, which the Companion Bible points out is necromancy, conjuring up spirits of the dead. And some even say that human sacrifice was involved. That's how low the children of Israel had fallen to this particular trap. And of course, God was angry that this had happened. And we're going to see that he's going to send a plague on Israel and actually call it for war against the people that had instigated this. Okay, let's continue on then. Then the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people, who apparently were the chief culprits, take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel, as a way of showing an example that the leaders had turned them the wrong way. But also, I'll point out that in the ancient Near East, back in those times, a person whose body was hung was regarded as suffering under a divine curse. So, continuing on then, verse number 5. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, every one of you kill his men who are joined in spiritual fornication, I'll add, to Baal of Peor. Okay, so the leaders of the people were to be hung. Now, as the Companion Bible points out, the number is not stated of how many were hung, but apparently it must have been 1,000. Because as we come to verse number 9, we're going to find that 24,000 died in the plague. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 8, the Apostle Paul puts down that 23,000 died in the plague. So what happens is Paul doesn't include the 1,000 of the leaders that apparently died here on that particular day. But 1,000 of them is a good number. And hang, as the Companion Bible points out, means that they were impaled or nailed to the stake as in a type of crucifixion. And in the sun probably means so that all the public can see to witness that the leaders had taken them down the wrong path. Okay, continuing on, verse number 6. And indeed, it gets even worse. One of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of the congregation of the children of Israel who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So what's going on here is these 1,000 leaders have been hung. They're out in the sun where everybody sees what's going on. And many of the children of Israel are gathered at the tent of the congregation of the tabernacle, and they're crying and weeping because of what has gone going on now, and probably understanding the mistakes that had been made. But while that's going on, one of the children of Israel came, as it says, presented, or in the old King James, it's brought, which is in the sense of brought a sacrifice, a type of sacrifice to the tabernacle. He brings a Midianite woman in the sight of all the congregation, and he's going to commit fornication. Verse number 7. Now when Phinehas, this is Aaron's grandson, the son of Eleazar, the son of the priest, saw it, he rose from among the congregation, took a javelin in his hand. Verse 8. And he went after the men of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her body. And so the plague was stopped among the children of Israel. And those who died in the plague were 24,000. So a plague had already been started by God because of what had taken place. And the leaders have already been hung. And in the midst of all of this that's going on, one of the children of Israel brings this Midianite woman in, into this tent, and they're unfortunately doing what they shouldn't have been doing. Phinehas takes a spear and kills them. Okay, so up until this point, relations with the Midianite woman had taken place outside the camp. But one brazen Israelite brought one into the camp in plain view. All right, let me point some more things out here. Phinehas, who's Eleazar, who's the high priest now, Phinehas, his son, killed them both. The Israelite man and the Midianite woman, and the plague was stopped. Their names are going to be given when we come to verses 14 and 15. Now notice in verse number 18, it says, into the tent. Now if you read that, you might think that that's talking about the tabernacle tent, but it's not. The tabernacle, the word for tabernacle, for tent in Hebrew is ohel. And the Hebrew word here for this tent is kubah. And that particular meeting, this is the only place where it occurs in the Old Testament. As the Companion Bible points out, this tent was a high and vaulted pleasure tent used in the worship of Baal. So what's going on here in between the lines? This particular Israelite and this Midianite woman set up this pleasure tent in the view of all of Israel to do what they were doing. And of course, Phinehas goes into that tent and kills the two of them. And when he does this, the plague stops, but unfortunately, 24,000 had died in the meantime. Verse number 10. Okay, well, I got one more frame here I forgot about. Verse number 9 talks about the 24,000 that had been killed. This includes the 1,000 that had previously been hanged from verse 4 and 5, as well as those who died of the plague. So the 23,000 plus the 1,000 equals the 24,000. The Apostle Paul mentions 23,000 in 1 Corinthians 10, verse number 8. Okay, moving on then, verse number 10. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel, because he was zealous with my zeal among them, so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. So God is saying, because of Phinehas' action, the plague stopped. Otherwise, all of Israel would have died. Therefore, verse 12, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace. It shall be to him and his descendants after him a covenant of everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the children of Israel. So, as verse number 11 points out, he was zealous with zeal among them, so that I did not consume Israel, God said. Tyndale commentary adds this. In other words, because Phinehas executed the sinner, expressing so clearly and visibly God's own anger through his deed, that anger was turned away. And God says through Phinehas, he would establish a covenant of everlasting priesthood. Tyndale adds this. Israel had broken the covenant by worshiping foreign gods. Phinehas had restored the covenant by his deed and is therefore rewarded with the covenant of a perpetual priesthood. This covenant with Phinehas is probably a guarantee that the high priesthood would always remain in his family. And there's a reference of 1 Chronicles chapter 6 and verse number 4 that the priesthood continued on with the line of Phinehas. Now we come to the names of these two that brazenly had committed this act in sight of all of Israel. Verse 14. Now the name of the Israelite who was killed with the Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of a father's house among the Simeonites. So this fellow was a leader, and he was of the tribe of Simeon. Now we're going to find, when we come to chapter 26, which is another census, that Simeon loses a lot of their people, because apparently a lot of them were involved in what had been going on here. Verse 15, and the name of the Midianite woman who was killed was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur, and he was a head of the people of a father's house in Midian. Cozbi here, interestingly, means deception. And it's pointed out by expositors that she was a priestess of paganism. And expositors actually said she was a type of Jezebel in this particular time. Okay, then continuing on, verse number 16. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, harass the Midianites and attack them. In other words, God is saying, make war against the Midianites, because apparently the Midianites that were living in this area were very influential with what had been going on in this particular event to cause Israel to fall so badly. If you're reading in the original King James, the word is vex the Midianites, which literally means show hostility towards them or attack them. Verse 18, here's the reason why God tells to attack them. For they harassed you with their schemes by which they seduced you in the matter of Peor and in the matter of Cozbi, the daughter of a leader of Midian, their sister, who was killed in the day of the plague because of Peor. So Midianites had been very influential in what had happened to Israel, and so God declares war on them. Going back to Numbers chapter 22, verse number 7, talking about the Midianites, it said this in verse 7, "So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the diviner's fee in their hand, and they came to Balaam and spoke to him the words of Balak." So the elders of Midian were very influential in trying to get Balaam to curse Israel. And what happens is, with Balaam's influence, they are very influential in causing Israel to fall in this event. They had been in league with Balaam from the very beginning, and apparently the principal culprits. So, as we read in verse 17, God announces a campaign against the Midianites. God gave instructions to attack them and harass them, to engage them in a battle as a means of vengeance. Now, that battle is going to be recorded in chapter 31. We're not actually going to come to that yet. But the battle is declared by God to take it to the Midianites. But before that can happen, we're at the end of this chapter now, chapter 25, before a battle can take place, another census has to come about. Because remember, going back to Numbers chapter 1, God had all the leaders number their people to make war, to eventually go into the land of Canaan and clean up all of the perversity that they would find there. But all those people that had been numbered died in the wilderness wanderings. So now, the new generation, they have to be numbered to be able to go and make war, not only in Canaan, but against the Midianites as well. So the next chapter is dealing with that census, the numbering of the new generation. 40 years had passed, and the generation who came out of Egypt were dead. And another census is taken for the new generation. And one of the reasons is because God had declared war against the Midianites and eventually the Canaanites. Verse number 1. It came to pass after the plague in 25:9, where 24,000 died altogether, came to pass after the plague that the Lord said to Moses and Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saying, verse 2, take a census of all the congregation of the children of Israel from 20 years old and above, by their fathers' houses, all who are able to go to war in Israel. So 20 years of old age was the fighting age to be able to go to war. This is one of the reasons why another census has to be taken of the new generation. And of course, God had just declared war on the Midianites for what they had done to Israel. Verse 3, so Moses and Eleazar the priest spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan, across from Jericho, saying, take a census of the people from 20 years old and above, just as the Lord commanded Moses and the children of Israel who came out of the land of Egypt. So a second census is going to take place. Part of the purpose of the census, number one, was for those who are able to go to war. As I already pointed out, a campaign against Midian had been declared, and eventually the conquest of Canaan was imminent. But there was another reason to take a census, and that is for inheritance purposes. How the land would be divided amongst the tribes. And when we come to verse 54 of this chapter, it will talk about the inheritance of the tribes according to the numbers from this census. Okay, now, this chapter goes on quite a bit about all the family history and the numbers that were done in the census. I'm not going to read all of this, all these names of the family names, just for time's sake. I'm just going to highlight the census numbers that were taken at that particular time. This one has to do with the tribe of Reuben, and we see that their total in this census was 43,730 from verse number 7. This is a decrease of 2,770 from Numbers chapter 1. Verse 21. And this is an interesting point from the Companion Bible, that from the very beginning here, this first number from the census, it says, this is an undesigned evidence of accuracy. An uninspired writer would have made an increase. So in other words, somebody wanting to build things up who wasn't inspired by God would say, would add to the numbers rather than showing a decrease that had taken place. Okay, one thing that I do want to point out about this, about the children of Reuben, remember that Korah was of the tribe of Reuben, and he had rebelled against Moses and Aaron, and many of them had died in that particular rebellion. But verse number 11 points out, nevertheless, the children of Korah did not die in that particular event that took place. And this is important because his descendants became prominent in the later temple worship. In fact, 11 of the Psalms were written by descendants of Korah. So even though Korah had rebelled, his descendants did live on. Okay, the next group was the Simeonites. Simeon had a huge decline from the first census. The first census was, notice this, almost 60,000. Now they're down to 22,000, a decrease of 37,100. And most of the commentaries point out, even though it's not stated here, Simeon must have been involved big time in what had happened with this event with Israel. And therefore many of them died. It's not known for sure, but it could be. Another thing that we can point out about Simeon, and this is pointed out in some of our literature, like United States and Britain and Prophecy, etc., is that Simeon was prophesied by Jacob to be scattered in Israel. And in our writings, we've talked about the fact that many of the Simeonites could have left at this particular time and already made their way to northwestern Europe. Perhaps that's part of the reason why there was a decrease in their numbers as well. Okay, the next group, the next tribe was Gad. They had a decrease of 5,150 from the first census. And again, there's a list of all the family members, and we'll skip that for time's sake. The next tribe was Judah. Judah had an increase of 1,900 from the first census. Verse 23 describes the sons of Issachar and their families. Issachar had an increase of 9,900 from the first census. Next on the list in verse 26 was Zebulun. Their total was 65,500. They had an increase of 3,100 from the first census. The sons of Joseph, according to their families, by Manasseh and Ephraim. Now, Companion Bible points out that Manasseh is pointed out first here because they had increased, and previously Ephraim had been named first. The sons of Manasseh, their totals are 52,700. Okay, verse 33, this is something that I need to point out here. It says in verse 33, that Zelophehad had no sons, but only had daughters. Now, this is going to pose a problem of the inheritance of the land. And we're going to run into that in the next short chapter, chapter 27. The solution is going to be discussed in chapter 27. In the ancient times, when land was inherited, it always went to the sons. The daughters, unfortunately, did not have any say in it, nor did they receive. It always went to the sons. So Zelophehad, who was one of the sons of Manasseh, one of the descendants, he didn't have any sons, only daughters. We come to chapter 27. They're going to come to Moses and say, wait a minute, hold the phone. We deserve land. And we're going to discuss that in chapter 27. Okay, Manasseh had an increase of 20,500 from the first census, a huge increase. Ephraim, their totals were 32,500. They had a decrease of 8,000 from the first census, which might be the reason why they are named first here in this section, or second, I should say. Benjamin, their numbers were 45,600. They had an increase of 10,200 from the first census. Dan had an increase of 1,700. From the first census. Asher, their totals were 53,400, an increase of 11,900 from the first sentence. And we're coming down to the last ones here now, the last one. Naphtali, verse 28, their numbers were 45,400, a decrease of 8,000 from the first sentence. Verse 50 is a summary of all the totals of all the tribes, and the total of verse 51 is the summary total, and the number is 601,730. So that's the total that's done in this second census of the young generation. In Numbers chapter 2 verse 30, the first census was 603,550. This was only a decrease of 1,820 from the first census. So when you consider 40 years of wandering and all the plagues and all the things that had happened to the children of Israel during this time, it was only a slight decrease in their numbers when we put all of it together. Okay, continuing on now. We've talked about the fact that one of the reasons for the census was for the campaign of war against the Canaanites. But there's also another reason, and that's described here as we continue on. Verse 52. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, to these, all the ones that had been numbered, the land shall be divided as an inheritance according to the number of their names. So because of this sentence, the land could be distributed to the tribes. Verse 54, to a large tribe, you shall give a larger inheritance. To a small tribe, a smaller inheritance. Each shall be given its inheritance according to those who are numbered of them. Verse 55, but the land shall be divided by lot, and they shall inherit according to the names of the tribes of their fathers. So what this is saying is the numbers is going to affect the size of what they get, but where they get their inheritance is going to be determined by lot, by the Urim and Thummim of the high priest. Verse 56, according to the lot of their inheritance, it shall be divided between the larger and the smaller. So as I just mentioned, the promised land will be divided to the size of the tribes who are larger or smaller. The larger ones receive more land and the smaller, the smaller. But the precise allocation was determined by lot. Verse 57. Okay, there's one tribe left that wasn't numbered, and that is the tribe of Levi. And that's because Levi serves in the tabernacle. They don't go to war. Verse 57. And these are those who are numbered of the Levites according to their families. Of Gershon, of the family of Gershonites, Kohath, of the family of Kohathites, and Merari, the family of the Merarites. So that's describing the family lineage here. And this continues on with the ones that were born, the descendants, etc. Verse 62 says that those were that were numbered of the Levites were 23,000, every male from a month old and above. So this was the census of the Levites. They received no land because their duties are religious. And during the wilderness wandering, the Levites increased in numbers from 22,000 to 23,000. And again, they don't receive any land. Verse 63, summing it all up, these are those who are numbered by Moses and Eleazar the priest, who numbered the children of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho. Again, very close to the promised land. But among these, there was not a man of those who were numbered by Moses and Aaron, the priest, when they numbered the children of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. In other words, the old generation had died. For the Lord said of them, they shall surely die in the wilderness. So there was not left a man of them except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. So the generation that had come out of Egypt was completely gone, except for Caleb and Joshua, and that's being emphasized here in this section. Now, as we finish up this chapter, a question remains. Because Moses isn't going to go into the promised land, who's going to succeed him as leader of Israel? Who's going to go take Israel into the promised land? That's actually going to be answered in the next chapter, the last part of it. Okay, one more chapter. This is a short one. Chapter 27, remember Zelophehad had no sons, he only had daughters. That's what we're going to deal with here first. Verse number 1, then came the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, from the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and these were the names of his daughters: Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. Verse number 2. And they, these daughters, stood before Moses and before Eleazar the priest. They're going to make their case now. They want to inherit land. And before the leaders of Israel and all the congregation by the doorway of the tabernacle of meeting, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Lord in company with Korah, but he died in his own sin and he had no sons." So they're saying, our father was one of those that died with all the rest in the wilderness, and he didn't have any sons. Verse number 4, why should the name of our father be removed from among his family because he had no son? And then they say this, give us a possession among our father's brothers. Okay, so they're in front of Moses, in front of Eleazar, and all the leaders and all the congregation, they're making this plea. Give us land in the promised land. Okay, Tyndale commentary adds this. Zelophehad had no sons. Therefore, under traditional law, his inheritance would on his death be transferred to his nearest male relative. By that means, the land would be kept within the family. So it would go to another male relative, cousin or whatever, but not the daughters. His daughters challenged this accepted practice, pleading that it would lead to their father's name being forgotten. Their plea was accepted. Okay, so Moses is going to take this to God. Verse five. So Moses brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "The daughters of Zelophehad speak what is right. You shall surely give them possession of inheritance among their father's brothers, and cause the inheritance of their father to pass on to them. And you shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, you shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughter." This was unprecedented in the ancient world. This didn't happen amongst the other nations, but God was allowing it to happen with Israel. Furthermore, verse 9, if he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. In other words, to keep it within the family. Verse 11, and if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the relative closest to him in his family, and he shall possess it. And it shall be to the children of Israel a statute of judgment, just as the Lord has commanded. Okay, God said that the daughters speak what is right, back in verse number 7. Here's a comment from the Nelson Study Bible. God's decision was that the daughters of Zelophehad had presented a just cause. They would inherit the land in the name of their father. This case would become precedent for other families in which there were no sons, only daughters. If there were no daughters, the inheritance would go to the nearest surviving relative. This was a significant departure from the custom of the day, as I already had mentioned. Okay, this next section, verses 12 through 14, Moses, as we know, is not allowed to go into the promised land because he had struck the rock, going back to the incident at Meribah. But God allows him to get a glimpse of the promised land before he dies. His days are numbered on the earth, but God does allow him to see the promised land. And this is something that none of the rest of those that died in the wilderness were able to do. They died in the wilderness, but God allowed Moses to at least see the promised land. Verse 12. Now the Lord said to Moses, go up into this Mount Abiram and see the land which I have given to the children of Israel. And when you have seen it, you also shall be gathered to your people. In other words, you're going to die, as Aaron your brother was gathered. He died. Here's the reason. Verse 14. For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against me, against my command to hallow me at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribah at Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. So because Moses struck the rock at Meribah against the way that God had told him to do, he was not permitted to go into the promised land. But God did allow him to view the land of Canaan from this high point of this mountain, Mount Abiram. And unlike the children of Israel who had died in the wilderness, Moses did at least get to see the promised land. Now, we still have the issue. Moses is going to die. This chapter finishes up with who's going to succeed him. Verse 15. Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep without a shepherd." Moses heard the words, God saying, you're going to be gathered to your people, you're going to die. So Moses is saying, they need a leader. Now notice this phrase here, the God of the spirits of all flesh. Sometimes people ask, what does that mean? That's a title that only appears here in this particular verse. The Bible Knowledge Commentary says, this refers to God's understanding of everyone, which guaranteed the wisdom of his choice. God's wisdom to be able to select a leader in this particular situation. That's what that refers to. The leader that would be the true leader that they would need at this important time in their history. We're going to see who that leader is here now. Verse 18. The Lord said to Moses, after Moses had prayed to God, take Joshua the son of Nun with you, a man in whom is the Spirit. We'll see in the book of Deuteronomy, that Spirit is the Spirit of wisdom. And lay your hand on him. Set him before Eleazar the priest, and before all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight. And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. So Joshua, as we know, had already proven himself to be a leader with godly qualities and character to serve. And he's going to be set before the congregation, as pointed out in verse number 19, which is a public appointment, so that the whole nation would know that Joshua is the one that's going to take over from Moses, and that he would receive some of Moses' authority. Verse 21, and he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. At his word they shall go out, at his word they shall come in, and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation. In the last two verses of this chapter, so Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua, set him before Eleazar the priest, and before all the congregation. He laid his hands on him, inaugurated him, just as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses. And we do that today when we ordain somebody, like for instance a deacon or an elder in the church, we lay hands on them and ask for God to give them wisdom, to give them leadership qualities, and to serve in the way that God would have them do. And that's what God had Moses do here with Joshua. He stood before Eleazar the priest to symbolize the relationship between the new leader and the priest. And finally, it's by the judgment of the Urim. And Eleazar would reveal God's will by means of the Urim so Joshua could carry out God's directives. And that brings us to the end of this chapter. We've seen Israel fall big time. We've seen that they had to be numbered so that they could take a campaign against the Midianites. And now Joshua is ordained to be the leader in Israel. As we finish up, let's talk about a big lesson from today's Bible study. Israel was on the very threshold of going into the promised land, where they were tested, and they plunged into the abomination of idolatry and sin, as we read. Peter, in his day, in the first century AD, had false teachers that were coming into the church, and he referred to these false teachers going back to this event that happened that we just read about. Here's what Peter said. They have forsaken the right way, gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. Unrighteousness is against God's law and God's word. In other words, apostasy. And that was happening in Peter's day. The lesson for us from these examples is we must be aware and recognize apostasy and keep our focus on God's way and the kingdom. Apostasy happened in the time of Israel. It happened in the time of the first century church in Peter's day. It happened in our day and time when we look back in our history of the church. And it can happen again. We always have to be aware, and we have to keep our focus on God's way. Great lesson for us to learn. So that's the end of the study today. Unless anybody has any particular questions or comments. Okay, very good. Sounds good then.